Well, hello. My name is Mike Diedrich, and this is the Veterans for Peace Daniel Ellsberg Chapter radio program, broadcast on KODX 96.9 FM. It will be archived there, and also in the Veterans VFP 92 website. With me today is Mark Ginsberg, who is a one of the authorities on Cuba, a professor, I believe. I'll let him introduce himself and get started on the program. So thanks, Mark, for showing up, and go ahead.
Okay, and Mike, thank you, and thanks to the Seattle chapter of Veterans for Peace for having invited me to for an earlier presentation, online presentation. As Mike said, my name is Mark Ginsberg. I'm a resident of Santa Cruz, California, but I've lived in a variety of places around the world, including for 2 semesters in Cuba. I lived between 2017 and 19, and was teaching at what's called the Pedagogical Science University there. But I've also lived in Cairo and Pittsburgh and Washington, D.C., among other places. All of those places, particularly starting in the 90s in Pittsburgh, I've been active in Cuba solidarity work with various local organizations. And I currently am active with a group that's called the Bay Area Cuba Solidarity Network, which has a very broad concept of the Bay Area, stretching from Sacramento all the way down to where I live in Santa Cruz. But it's kind of Northern California, Cuba solidarity activists. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to participate this past weekend, but we hosted two of the Cuban diplomats from the Cuban embassy who did several events, one major public event on Saturday, but also some smaller events with legal representatives, lawyers and people who work in criminal justice, with groups that are active in solidarity. With Cuba and several other more specific events, including with the National Nurses United, the California Nurses Association group in the Bay Area. I've started my involvement with Cuba as an academic, if you will. I remember in graduate school being impressed with the articles I read about the Cuba's literacy campaign in 1961, and followed it to some extent, but it wasn't a major focus of my efforts until I moved to Pittsburgh. And at that point, I got involved in the Cuba Studies program there, which has a long history, a long set of relationships with the University of Havana. And also because there was a very active Cuba solidarity organization there, actually focused on sister city relationships between Pittsburgh and the city of Matanzas. And that was the kind of beginning of my more active Cuba solidarity engagement, in part because, in the late 80s and early 90s, Cuba's main economic relationships evaporated basically with the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the Eastern European socialist countries. And the situation, which was named by the Cubans a special period in a time of peace, was a very challenging one. I mean, in comparison to what's going on today, some people, some Cubans I know look back and say, it wasn't that bad in comparison to today. The situation is even worse. But anyway, because of that, and because the U.S. decided to ramp up its sanctions against Cuba in 1992, for example, the U.S. Congress for the first time legislated the embargo, or what I tend to call the blockade, with the Torricelli bill. And then in 96, the Helms-Burton bill, which was a major escalation, but also legislating it, which meant that when Obama decided he was going to change Cuba policy, he only had certain levers. Congress controlled the rest, and Congress hasn't exactly been a friend of Cuba, and I would have to say most of the administrations haven't. Anyway, that was the start of it, and I, as I said, I've lived there. I've traveled there probably 30 times. I don't know if I'd consider myself an expert. I'm certainly a student of Cuba, and part of that is through my reading and articles that I've written, collaborating with Cuban colleagues and others, to look at education mainly, but I've also given attention to what I call the economic and media war against Cuba. So that continues to today, and as Mike and I were talking just before we went on air, my next trip to Cuba I planned for September. Unfortunately, I can't travel in August because there's going to be a lot of North Americans in Cuba and people from all over the world because it's an event to celebrate the 100-year anniversary of Fidel's birth. Let me leave it as that as an introduction if you want to pick up on any of the points and or what topics should we focus on?
Well, perhaps you could give a truncated version of Cuba, at least in the 20th century, and on how the United States and Cuba got to this point. I mean, a lot of people do not know that history in this country in particular. Americans are notorious for their short-term memory on history, and including their own. But I mean, just a little background before we, get into sort of the current situation.
Okay, I'd be glad to do that. It's a long and complicated and not very positive history, I would say. But you actually have to go back to the time of the US Revolution, even before that. Some of the leaders and some of the first presidents of the United States had already identified Cuba as a territory that they would like to incorporate. And as I think most listeners would know, going south to Cuba to expand U.S. territory wasn't the only expansion that was going on. The U.S. was taking over lands and basically colonizing parts of the U.S. that were populated by Native Americans, and Cuba was just another example of the attempt to expand the territory. But not too much specifically happened, although there were ongoing trade relations from the beginning, and certainly people traveled to Cuba because of the amazing climate and beaches. But Cuba, during the 19th century, launched actually what I would say three different efforts at independence from Spain. At that point, Cuba was a Spanish colony. And in the latter one, which some people may recognize the name Jose Marti, was one of the key leaders of the Cuban Revolutionary Party. He lived in the US, had been exiled when he was a teenager. Anyway, the Cuban Independence Army was almost, in my view, about to expel Spain from Cuba. And then the US intervened. So we're talking 1898. And in fact, sent Depeche troops to Cuba in that year. And military occupation of Cuba for a period of time. It was the first of I think three different times that the US military occupied Cuba. But that was the start of it. All of this, of course, is before Cuba's revolution in 1959. I mean, part of the legacy of that is what is called Guantanamo Bay base. That was part of what was under duress ceded to the U.S. The right of what at that point was called a coaling station, a location that the Navy could use to fuel their ships. But that naval base continues to exist today. It's disputed, obviously, by the current Cuban government, the legitimacy of it. But there were treaties that were signed under duress, although in many cases treaties can be removed if the government on one side no longer wants it. But the clever people who drafted that the treaty, actually the most recent one from the 1930s, made it so only with both parties agreeing to end the occupation of that land, would it be possible to do so. But after the revolution in 1959, even before, you could see some paperwork in the State Department indicating a concern about Cuba's revolutionary movement in the 50s. But after the success of the revolution that was led by Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, and others, the US really started to put economic pressure on the island. There's a infamous, I would say, memo that the State Department issued in 1960 that says, based on our analysis, it appears that the Cuban people are enthusiastic about the revolutionary government and are unlikely to do anything about it. In fact, they want to work with us, support it. So what we need to do is put economic pressure on the island to make people miserable, basically, in order that they somehow are inspired to rise up and overthrow the government. And that, in a way, is a memo that continues to describe the policy of the U.S. It's gone up and down at various points in time. Currently, it's probably the most strangling of the economic war against Cuba. The U.S. also supported efforts to intervene militarily, if you will. They had a group of mercenaries that invaded in 1961. There were a number of bombings and other terrorist acts that were not necessarily carried out by the CIA, but there's evidence that the CIA was involved in promoting these, because you had a group of Cubans who were not in favor of the revolution and could be mobilized to bomb hotels, to spray crops, to devastate the production of coffee or tobacco or whatever. And it's continued to this day. During the Obama years, really the last years of the Obama administration, a move was made to renormalize relations with Cuba. It couldn't, in fact, do away with the embargo because that was legislated, as I mentioned. But the embassies were reopened in Havana and in Washington, D.C. I actually lived about five blocks away from the Cuban embassy. When I moved there, it was called the interest section. And things got a little bit better. There were a lot of conversations between representatives of two governments on issues like drug trafficking and migration and whatnot. But with the election of Trump in 2016, the small gains that the Obama administration had made in terms of improving relations were basically reversed. And during his first administration, Trump somehow managed to find 243 more sanctions that could be directed at Cuba. And one thing he did, which to me is not just ironic, I mean, it's ridiculous that Cuba is on a list of so-called state sponsors of terrorism, when in fact the U.S. should be on that list for its actions against the island nation. As I said, a number of actions that were taken, and we don't have 2 hours to go down a huge list, and I obviously can't produce it, but it is a very long list of terrorist actions that have been directed at the island nation, with the very clear support and sometimes more active direction of the U.S. government. Biden didn't do much on Cuba relations, despite campaign promises. Until the last few days of his administration, when he removed Cuba from the state sponsors of terrorism list, I think quite aware that Trump would immediately put them back. So it was, kind of smoke and mirrors operation. Since that time, Trump, and I guess it's important to mention his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, a descendant of Cuba's, who was born in the U.S. and made much of his career of speaking out against what he calls the communist regime in Havana. But they've upped the ante, put Cuba back on the state sponsors terrorism list. And just to clarify, that list makes it very difficult for international banks and many companies around the world to do business with Cuba, because built into that is a possibility of sanctions against those countries for dealing with a state sponsor of terrorism. Probably more concerning is the January 26, I believe, executive order, which basically promises any country that supplies oil to Cuba with economic sanctions. This was after the US's January 3rd abduction of Nicolas Maduro and in some ways increasing its control over Venezuelan oil. I mean, the first thing it did was made sure that no Venezuelan oil was going to go to Cuba. And more recently, there have been a number of reports and a number of statements by both Trump and Rubio, and for that matter, Secretary Hegseth of the Department of War, as it's now called, that Cuba is, kind of in the list of future military actions. Some of us believe that the only delay, the only reason that hasn't occurred thus far is that the US and Israel got embroiled in a conflict with Iran, which they thought would be very quick and decisive. But it's obviously gone on for a long time, and it's just the conflict has kind of re-escalated. But because of that, a lot of US military resources are in that region and not available for any kind of action against Cuba. But I just read an article this morning that there have been discussions among military leadership of different options of how they would wage war against Cuba, whether it would be a aerial attack, whether there would be any infantry or soldiers on the ground as part of an invasion, or at least maybe similar to Venezuela, an abduction of the leadership of the country. I mean, one thing that some people think was illustrative of U.S. planning is when Raul Castro was indicted for his role as head of the Cuban military in 1996, when two civilian planes were shot down over Cuba. Of course, the backstory is that the U.S. and the organization Brothers to the Rescue that were flying those planes had been warned on several occasions that they were violating Cuban airspace and that they might suffer the consequences they actually suffered, but they continue to do so. The idea was the planes were really threatening the airspace and distributing leaflets and things like that. But as the head of the Cuban military at that point, Secretary of War would be the equivalent in the US, Raul was indicted, and some people think he may be the one who will be kidnapped, or that will be the reason for US action. I obviously don't know what's in the minds of the leadership of the US. I really hope that some wiser heads will intervene and discourage them from military action. But I think it's quite serious threat. It's not just verbal. There's planning going on, and in fact, Guantanamo Base was the area around Guantanamo Base. There was recent military exercises, and Secretary Hegseth of the Department of War arrived during that time and spoke to the assembled soldiers and basically reiterated the threats that at some point the U.S. Will take action, military action against Cuba. I guess the last thing I'll mention about the current situation is that in June, the president of Cuba, Miguel Díaz-Canel, along with other leadership, I'm sure, but he's the one who presented it to the Cuban Communist Party, and then eventually it went to the National Assembly of People's Power, which is the legislative branch of the Cuban government. 176 economic measures, opening up some areas for private enterprise, if you will, and changing somewhat the role that foreign companies can play on the island. I mean, there have been foreign country co company investments for a long time. It had always been with a minority share, maybe 49% of a hotel chain that's managed by the Spanish was owned by the Spanish company, but the 51% was the Cuban state. So there are some moves. I mean, I just read a review of some of these, not only by me, the president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, but also the head of the National Assembly, listing them. And some of them are changes that go a little bit further than what has been the case. I mean, the Cuban Constitution says that private enterprise is a part of the economic system. So this isn't like it violates the Constitution, but it does move forward. And in some ways, it's an effort to stimulate the Cuban economy by removing some restrictions and encouraging more decentralized decision making. But the same day that these came out, even though a lot of these are ones that somehow mirror what the U.S. administration has been saying, the re excuse me, the reaction was to add additional sanction some additional companies. But I don't know. I'm hoping that the prognosticators are wrong, that the U.S. is actually going to launch a military action against Cuba. But certainly the warning signs are very, very visible. Let me stop at that point, Mike, and I can pick up on some of the points I've raised, or we can go on to other topics.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Just as sort of a comment as a combat Vietnam veteran, I'm somewhat familiar with the war and the well, basically the futility of it. But the United States is, I think, one of the reasons that they have not put any sort of troops on the ground in Iran is the complications of putting troops on the ground. It's got, some of them would be killed. The United States doesn't have much stomach for that, and I think that any action in Cuba would, in addition to aerial bombardment with ground troops, would be the same sort of scenario. And the Cubans are, as I understand it, they don't have very sophisticated weapons. They've got a lot of sort of Soviet era, but they're awash in conventional weaponry, that is, machine guns,
Rifles and
rifles and
machine
machine guns,
guns.
as much of the population actually have access to this. So it would be a very difficult sort of thing to put some troops on there and keep them there. The United States, that Cubans don't have really an air force or a navy that would be of any impediment to the United States. But as we've witnessed in Iraq, in Iran. I mean, they've been blowing the hell out of that country, and the regime there is not going to give up. And I think it'd be very difficult compared to Venezuela to go in there and successfully abduct some of the leadership. And even as they did, would that make much of a difference? I kind of doubt it because of the Communist Party has got multiple layers of command and authority. I mean, there's the headliners, but I mean, it's a, as you've mentioned, it's a to enforce any sort of thing, they'd really have to put troops on the ground, and I don't think that's going to happen. The one of the reasons I think that they haven't done it in Iran is that the United States military is okay. We'll bomb, and that's fine. But getting into something like that, I mean, the United States military is at fault for some of its th things that they've said. Well, we can do this. We can do this. Well, Afghanistan, Iraq, and to say nothing of Vietnam, really, it's a real can of worms when you start to they talk about regime change. I don't think it's good. There's going to be any regime change in Cuba. I mean, they could kill some Cuban leadership, but I don't think there's going to be any regime change. That's just my opinion.
Yeah,
So
I
I'm.
mean, one indication of that to me is when I was last in Cuba for May Day, 1st of May. Interestingly, an international day of workers that almost every country in the world except the US celebrates, despite it being based on events that took place in Chicago in 1896, I believe it was. But anyway, I was there, and one of the announcements at the May Day rally, which was held just across from where the US Embassy is located, not accidentally, I would, I'm sure, was that more than 6.2 million Cuban adults, age 16 and above, about 80% at that point, I think it's gone up since then, have signed a pledge to defend Cuba against military action, and even without saying military action by the US. So I think that's the case. But what happened in Venezuela, I guess is one of the possibilities that our esteemed leadership in the US are and in the military are thinking about. But as I said, with the war raging in against Iran, it's not likely to happen, and I'm hoping it never happens. And if anybody dies, I think that's a terrible result of war, but I think it would be much, much more. I mean, about 100 people died from the action in Venezuela on January 3rd. A sizable group of Cubans were there to support the Venezuelan government, but they got killed as part of an action. And apparently, the U.S. has some new weapons that allow them to block off communication, and that was part of the reason for the success of that particular adventure, if you will. But meanwhile, the Cubans are definitely suffering. I mean, the articles I read and the interviews I hear from Cubans, and I have a few Cuban colleagues who I stay in touch with, but they tend to be less likely to tell me how difficult it is, but I know it's much more difficult than they're willing to admit. The electrical grid is old and needs repair, but when you don't have fuel to generate electricity, it's it means that there are blackouts, and sometimes the blackouts are for 24 hours or more, and they kind of circulate around the country. I mean, the good news about electrical power is that the Cubans have for a long time been working to build a alternative energy, particularly solar panels. And with the oil blockade, the fuel blockade, China has really upped its the ante and supplied a lot more solar panels. So even when there is a total blackout, if you will, because the electrical grid is not able to carry fuel generated electricity, a number of hospitals and other key institutions are continuing to operate because they have solar panels. Unlike what happens in the US, when you have solar panels in Cuba, they go to the most needed buildings and institutions, ones that serve the people. So hospitals, in particular, some of the schools, certainly the clinics and homes for the aged have solar panels now. So the situation, as I say, is not good, but it's not quite as bad as the reports about, a total blackout. I've also heard that with some of these measures, it may be possible for Cuba to start importing oil again. Really, since January 3rd, the only tanker of petroleum that has come in was a Russian one that came in, if I remember correctly, in early June, or maybe it was late May, somewhere around there. And I'm still not sure why the Russian government arranged with Trump to be able to do that. I mean, we know about a relationship between the two leaders of those countries, but I've never been able to find anybody who had any background knowledge on how it happened. But that, one tanker is not going to make much difference. And in fact, when some groups in the US began to organize to send fuel to Cuba, the US administration came up with new restrictions on the companies in Cuba that would receive it, and so that kind of forced the group to back off. Last point I would make is I've heard that the Mexican government is going to reinitiate its efforts to send fuel to Cuba. It's been one of the major suppliers, along with Venezuela, before the January actions by the administration. But President Sheinbaum, sorry, kind of got scared into continuing to supply the oil because of the threatened economic sanctions. And obviously, Mexico is very dependent on the U.S. In a lot of ways, and I'm sorry that she took that decision, but I can understand why she would. But as I said, I've heard that they may start to ship oil again. Excuse me.
So, can you talk a little bit about sort of food and nutrition? I know that after the Russians pulled out, Cuba went through a very severe period of austerity, including reduced nutritional availability to the population. And how is that now with I mean, are they growing their own food at all? What sort of are they replying on imported food?
Yeah, well, they definitely are growing their own food. It's common about the special period, the 90s. I had met a number of friends and, who have become long-term friends and colleagues in the early 90s, when some of them, professors had traveled to Pittsburgh for a conference we organized. And then, when I met them in Cuba, and by the end of the 90s, I almost didn't recognize them. I mean, they had lost, maybe their doctors thought it was a good idea for them to lose weight, but not under those situation. I think that is happening today. Cuba does produce its own food. Not it's not like Venezuela, food sovereign, if you will. It can't produce. It doesn't produce all of the food that it needs, but does. The biggest challenge for food today in Cuba is a well, two things. One, there are some companies that and countries that are hesitating to send food to Cuba because of Trump's extraterritorial sanctions. They could get punished if they trade with Cuba. Banks similarly, and a lot of most countries borrow money to import things, so they can't do that. But even more immediate is there's food in one part of the island, but to transport it to other parts of the island requires fuel. And with a fuel shortage, that means that the trucks that normally would transport various food products from the rural areas or from one of the provinces that does more of the agricultural area to areas like Havana. I mean, the good news is that after the special period of the 90s, Cuba really started to grow food in urban areas, what they call urban gardens. I guess that's kind of an international concept. So that, a lot of schools and a number of companies and some individual households grow their own food. So it makes a difference, but that doesn't mean you're going to get access to the protein that you need. And I've also read, I haven't heard this directly from any of my friends or colleagues, but what they call the libreta, which is a kind of a a list of food products that are supplied either for free or at reduced costs by the government as part of the effort to maintain nutrition. A number of things on that list have either disappeared or have become less frequent or less abundant. Things like eggs and well, coffee and flour and some basic foodstuffs that were guaranteed. One of the economic measures I mentioned before that recently been introduced, 176 of them, talks about changing that whole program from universal distribution to distribution of these foodstuffs to people who are most in need. So kind of creating two categories of Cuban citizens. Historically, it's been, everybody would have access to it. Not everybody necessarily used it, but they're moving in a direction, again, trying to find what seems like the most reasonable and ethical way of distributing food and guaranteeing some level of nutrition to a population. But again, like healthcare and education, the provision of foodstuffs has been one of the promises of the revolution. And I have to imagine that at least some Cubans are finding these changes to be an abandonment, or at least a step back from what was the promise of the revolution. And let me just make one comment about healthcare, because to me, the Cuban healthcare system is not only, alleged to be, but I think in fact is one of the most impressive accomplishments of the revolution. At the time of 1959, the so-called triumph of the revolution, a lot of medical personnel migrated out of Cuba. They didn't agree with the direction the country was headed, which put a big dent in the supply of doctors and to some extent nurses and medical technicians. But Cuba managed to change that in a relatively short period of time. They put a lot of resources and recruited a lot of people into the medical field. Has one of the had up until recently, I haven't seen the most recent statistics, but had one of the best doctor to patient ratios in the world. And in fact, have more medical personnel outside of Cuba and around the world than the World Health Organization does. So they've really taken healthcare to another level. I mean, I've had the chance to visit neighborhood clinics. I mean, it's hard to imagine in urban areas, let alone in rural areas, that every Cuban, up until recently at least, could walk to their doctor's office. And more importantly, their doctor and nurse could walk to their homes if they needed to be treated. It was, maybe 100 people per doctor's office. But that's being challenged in part because of a recent increase in migration of educated people from Cuba, but also mostly because even when you have a doctor to care for you and identify what kind of medications you need to have a pharmacy that provides those medicines. And trying to import some of the medicines continues to be a challenge because of the blockade. But equally important, Cuba has developed a very strong biopharma industry, if you will. But you can't produce medicines if you don't have the well, what I somewhat naively or not very scientifically call the ingredients that are necessary to produce the medications. And so, the times in the last year or two that I've walked by pharmacies, I have been really distressed at the empty shelves. I mean, there were some medications available, but not, what used to be the case of, abundant medications that meant that, you not only got the care of a doctor, but when you needed medicine, you could get access to it. And that's had an impact. I mean, one indication of that, and I think this, this was announced at a recent UN General Assembly meeting that Cuba convened to call for a vote against the US policies. But they noted that what historically had been four deaths per 10,000 births in the country had risen to almost 10 per 10,000. I mean, it's still a remarkably good ratio, if you will, certainly better than what the case is for, say, people of color in the US and many other countries, would have many more children who don't survive up to year one. But it's more than doubled, and that's a result of this intensified blockade.
So yeah, I had read some information about the, as you made, their research and production of medicines internally, and their some of their inventions, if you were, or advances in pharmaceutical, particularly using native plants or plant-based medicine.
Exactly. Yeah. They don't, well, medical schools, like some around the world, focus not only on, quote unquote, modern medicine, but also more traditional medicine. I'd insert here a couple of things. One, during COVID, because the US blocked Cuba from getting access to, vaccines on it, from around the world, including US companies that got subsidized by our tax dollars to make a profit on inoculating us. But they developed their own vaccines. It took them a little bit longer than but by 2021, Cuba had successfully tested three vaccines and began to inoculate their citizens, and also have done a lot of did a lot of COVID related vaccinations outside of Cuba and in around the world. The other thing I'd mention, in fact, a friend and I are doing a film event on Wednesday of next week on Cuba's development of a treatment for Alzheimer's disease. The trials to date suggest a very successful treatment. And the moment I'm blanking on the name of the medication that they develop, but at least one doctor in the US has taken some of his patients down there, and the Cuban research shows that if Alzheimer's is identified early enough, it can be either the advancement of the disease is either halted, or in fact, some of the patients are actually cured of it. I mean, this is a huge thing that, to me, is one important example of how the blockade actually works against those of us living in the US. Because if we had normal relations with Cuba, not only would there be clinical trials in the US on this Alzheimer's drug, but so many of our elderly citizens who are getting ravaged by Alzheimer's could be either prevented or cured, or at least slowed down in the advancement of the disease. So it's just two examples of of Cuba's amazing scientific achievements.
Yeah, that is quite remarkable. I mean, we could also benefit from their research in COVID vaccines, which this country is not has a spotty record in actually supporting that research and development. It's a yeah, that is a tragedy, really, and it seems like United States actions against Cuba are really vengeful and vicious and petulant. We've been doing this for what, 40 years, 50 years now, and
60 plus,
60 plus, yeah. And the reasons for doing it are, I think, are really not invalid if they were to start with.
And let me just mention one other one. I should have included this as list of the pharmaceutical biopharma accomplishments. Cuba has developed a treatment for foot ulcers that come with advanced stages of diabetes, diabetic foot ulcers, which leads in many cases to amputation. They have managed to develop this this medical treatment that basically cures the gets the ulcers to disappear, if you will, and saves the foot or the leg from being amputated. I don't remember the most recent figures, but the number of people with diabetes in the US is huge. And of that, a fraction, maybe 15, 20%, end up having amputations because of the ulcers that are generated or created by the disease. Again, a lot of people could benefit in the US if we had normal relations with Cuba.
Well, this is very important information, particularly the medical information of what how more developed in many respects the Cuban government is than ours. I'm going to have to truncate our little our discussion, and thank you again for doing this. I've got a my parameters for this is 55 minutes because of the so we're about there. So thank you, Mark Ginsburg, for this. And this is the Veterans for Peace radio show, Daniel Ellsberg, Chapter 92. This program will be broadcast on KODX 96.9 FM. Thanks again.
Last words for me are no war against Cuba.